Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question and answer session, please press star one on your touch-tone phone. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now I'll turn today's meeting over to Jim Mulvary. Thank you, sir. You may begin.
Great. Thank you, Candy. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining our call today. Just right at the beginning, let me give you my phone number. It's 562-980-4006. If you need anything after this conference call, be sure and give me a ring. I'll be standing by. I have with me today Justin Vesbecki, the NOAA Stranding Coordinator for West Coast Region. That's in Long Beach, California. Justin coordinates with all rescue centers in California and has some updated numbers on the number of marine mammal stranding sea lions that is going on off our coast. Also have Sharon Moline, a wildlife biologist with NOAA's National Marine Mammal Laboratory. She's sitting in Seattle, Washington right now, but has been doing her research on the Channel Islands, mostly San Miguel and St. Nicholas, on sea lion rookeries. We also have Nate Mantua. He's a NOAA climatologist with the Southwest Fisheries Science Center. He's in Santa Cruz, and he can talk about some of the unusual ocean conditions we're seeing and occurring off our coast that may be affecting sea lions. So what I'll do is I'll open it up and just let all three of them give an opening statement, and then we'll open it up for questions. So go ahead, Jeff.
Okay, good morning, everybody. Again, my name is Justin Vesbecki. I am the NOAA Fisheries Stranding Coordinator for California. And so as you all know, we are currently seeing elevated or increased numbers of California sea lion strandings. In particular, these are mostly pups, are animals that would normally be weaning a little bit later on in the year. They're actually coming from the islands a little earlier than normal and in higher numbers than normal. Our current numbers in-house throughout all of our facilities in the state of California are approximately 550. And our year-to-date intakes throughout the state of California is about 940. So again, year-to-date is about 940, and that's, again, from January through about halfway through February. So as you can see, the numbers are pretty high. And I think that's one of the main things that we want the public to know is that because of this increase in numbers, our facilities, while they're doing the best that they can, they're very limited in the capacity with both space, resources, lots of different things. So we're asking the public to be very patient. Please report the sightings to us, but don't try to approach the animal on your own. Don't pick up the animal and attempt to bring it to one of the facilities on your own. One, it's not safe for people to pick up the animals. You could get bitten. There's potential for disease transfer. So we're asking, let us know, report it, but don't bring them in on your own. And also, please have a lot of patience with the facilities because, again, there's so many calls that we're getting. We just can't respond to them all, and that's, you know, part of the message is that the reality is that we can't get to all of these animals. We'll do our best, but, again, the capacity to take all of the animals that are coming ashore just isn't there. I think as far as what people can do, because people are always wondering, you know, what can we do, I think the main things, again, are going to be to report, to go to the facilities and actually volunteer your time. If people are wanting to know if they can help out, you could actually go and get involved with one of our network facilities, or you can donate monies to help provide the tools and the equipment and the things, the supplies that they need to get through these tough times. So it's kind of the reporting, donating time and or monies to help support what we're doing out there. I think otherwise, I think another real important point from the stranding network for us to let everybody know about is that, you know, the stranding component, the stranding network is comprised of a number of components, and rehabilitation is one of those components. But we're also looking at collecting science and information, education and outreach, lots of different components to this. It's not just rehabilitation. So while rehabilitation is important to us, there are other things that we think are equally as important, and that includes the science. And that's something that we really do like to mention is that each of these animals that does come ashore is a puzzle piece for us and provides information to hopefully give us kind of some big picture information, not only on this species, but the kind of the coastal marine environment and what's happening, you know, here off of Southern California and actually all of the West Coast. I think that's pretty much it as far as from the stranding network as for numbers, so I'll turn it over to Sharon, and then you guys can ask me questions in a little bit if you need to.
Thanks, Justin. Okay, this is Sharon Moline. I'm with the Alaska Fisheries Science Center National Marine Mammal Laboratory based in Seattle. And we do long-term research on California sea lions at the breeding rookeries in California. Mostly our work is on San Miguel and San Nicolas Island, so most of what I'm going to talk to you about and most of the data that we're going to be providing to you is from those two colonies. And I'm going to start with a little bit of life history just to kind of give everybody the same background. California sea lion pups are born in June, and they're weaned about 11 months later. They're solely dependent on their mother for nutrition until they're about 6 months old, so till about January or so. And then they begin to supplement their diet with small prey around the rookeries until they're weaned. At this age, when they're about 6 months old, they're not really capable of traveling very far or diving very deep, and their foraging abilities are not really fully developed, so they really aren't capable of being out on their own. And that's what makes these strandings so unusual, is that they really shouldn't be trying to leave the rookeries this early. Survival of pups that wean before the normal weaning time in April is pretty low, so their chances even in a normal condition is not very good when they wean early. The lactating females or their mothers, they take foraging trips that last 2 to 4 days. That's normal. And they travel from San Miguel Island or San Nicolas Island, and they can go as far north as Monterey Bay on a single foraging trip. And while she's out foraging, the pup is fasting at the rookery for that first, pretty much for that first six-month period. And then when she returns, she spends about a day to 2 days ashore nursing the pup, and then she leaves again, and she continues what we call an attendance cycle until from birth of the pup to the weaning. Now, females can adjust their foraging trip duration when prey is difficult to find, and we see this commonly in El Nino as a good example. Prey becomes more dispersed. Oftentimes it redistributes farther north, so it's more difficult for females to gain access to it. And if the trips become too long, then the pup isn't able to acquire enough energy when the female returns to nurse, and so it doesn't really overcome the weight that it loses during the fasting. And that results in slowed growth of the pups, which is what we're seeing currently, and in some cases it can be starvation. Few things about diet. Sea lions are opportunistic foragers. Their core diet, though, consists of Pacific sardine, northern anchovy, rockfish, Pacific hake, and market squid, but they feed on over 100 species of fish and squid, so this is by no means the only thing that they eat, but these are really important prey for them. The current population is estimated at about 300,000. It's very healthy. Grew steadily after it was protected in 1972 by the Marine Mammal Protection Act. In recent years, the growth has slowed, and we are working on data to look at whether the population might be approaching its resource limits in the environment. So then focusing on kind of what's going on right now, so let's just give you a little bit of background, and then what we've been observing now relative to this event is that in September of 2014, we have a regular program where we go out and weigh pups in September of every year. We've been doing that for mostly 40 years. And in this particular case, in September, pups were 19% below their normal weight, so they were about 14.1 kilograms. That's for female pups. And then we went back out in February of 2015, which we also do pretty much every year, to weigh them at 7 months old, just to kind of check on them, see how they're doing. And they were 44% below their normal weight. The average weight was only 14.6 kilos, so you can see that in that four-month period, they hadn't gained much weight at all. Normally, they should be about 25 kilograms. Their growth rate reflects that it was very, very low, only 0.009 kilograms a day, which only meant that they gained on average 1.2 kilograms over that four-month period. That is worse than, that's the lowest growth rate we've ever observed. 41% of the pups that we weighed in September, that we also weighed in February, either lost weight or they had no weight gain. There's very little mortality of pups on the island, which was a little bit surprising, but we also saw this in the UME event in 2012 and 2013. The mortality is occurring mostly once the pups leave the island. And we anticipate then, as Justin already started talking about, large numbers of strandings. We think this will continue, certainly into the spring. And the causes for the waits are being investigated. We're focusing on disease and prey availability and diet to females. We did instrument 12 females with satellite tags in December in preparation for this event. We saw it sort of coming, and we wanted to sort of see how females were provisioning their pups and how their behavior might, their behavior and their diet during this period. We're still acquiring those data. We don't really have any answers yet for you on that, except that they are foraging in their traditional foraging areas. They don't appear to be traveling a lot farther, but other things could be affecting their ability to take care of their pups, like their diet. They could be having to work a lot harder to get that prey, so there could be changes in their diving behavior and their attendance. They could be staying away longer, which would all result in a pup growing slower and potentially having pups come ashore in these emaciated states. And with that, I'll turn it over to Nate, who can talk more about the ocean conditions that might be causing all this.
Sure. So I'm Nate Mantua, and I have a background in climate, and my expertise is trying to link climate to marine ecosystems. The ocean off the west coast of the U.S. is currently very warm, about 2 to 5 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than the long-term average for this time of year, and it's been warm for much of the last year, although it developed sort of in patches. The first indication of the warming was regionally confined to Baja and the Southern California Bight in the spring of 2014, and that was caused by relatively weak winds out of the north, or a lack of the seasonal upwelling that usually happens there during the spring and early summer. In July, the warm water that was off Southern California and Baja expanded to cover much of the Central California coast, the whole Gulf of the Farallones, Monterey Bay, all the way up to about Point Arena. And then in September, the area of especially warm water expanded even further north, and it merged with a large area of warm water that had formed there independently during the winter of 2014. So now ocean temperatures are about, again, 2 to 5 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than average from the Aleutians all the way around the Northeast Pacific up to the coastal areas of Southeast Alaska, British Columbia, Washington, Oregon, California, and then in an arc that extends south of Hawaii. So a very large area of warm ocean temperatures, reminiscent of the kind of warming that we have seen in the past during extreme tropical El Nino events like 1997, 1983, 1957, 58, and in the early 1940s, especially 1940 and 41. So the warming is about as strong as anything that's in the historical record for the Northeast Pacific and the West Coast. But the thing that I think is especially unusual about it is the lack of a tropical El Nino event, a strong tropical El Nino event, to try and coordinate this and to make it persist. And if you just ask the question, you know, why is it warm without the El Nino? Well, the proximate cause are just a small number of persistent but alternating patterns of either weak winds out of the north or strong winds out of the south that have reduced the upwelling of cold water and the loss of heat from the ocean to the atmosphere, and also the currents that normally move from north to south that bring cooler water down to lower latitudes like Central and Southern California.
Is that it, Nate?
That's it for me.
Okay, great. I should also mention that this teleconference will be available afterwards. It's being recorded, so I can make that link available to anybody who's interested. So, Candy, go ahead. If you want to open it up for questions, that would be great.
Thank you. At this time, to ask a question, press star 1, please. please unmute your line and record your name to be introduced. Again, for questions or comments, press star 1. If you'd like to withdraw the request, you may press star 2. Thank you. One moment, please, for your first question. Thank you. Our first question comes from Tim Ryan. Your line is open, and state your affiliation.
Hi there. I'm with KCBS Radio in San Francisco. And my question perhaps to Jim, but at the very beginning, Jim, you mentioned 550 and you mentioned the number 940. I'm wondering if you could just clarify those two numbers. What do they mean?
So this is Justin Visbicki again, and the 940 is basically the year-to-date admits of California sea lions to our facilities. So those are the animals that have come in, and what we have currently in-house is 550 animals. So some of those animals have been released. Some of those animals didn't actually make it when they were brought in, but that just gives you an idea of the numbers that we have brought into our facilities in the first 6 weeks of this year.
Just to follow up on that, now in looking at the bottom of the press release, on a typical year, in 1 month you would get 45, so the math tells me that typically you would get 60 or 70 through mid-February. Is that right, 60 or 70 versus this year, 940?
Well, it depends upon the year. I'm trying to figure out what you're looking at as far as averages. Yeah, I mean, we're way above average this year. I mean, we're significantly above average. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question, Jed Kim. Your line is open and state your affiliation.
I'm from KPCC Public Radio in Los Angeles. And Justin, I have a question for you. How many pups can be handled at a time?
It depends upon the facility, and it depends upon resources at the facility. So it's not just capacity issues. It's people that are available to help out on certain shifts. It's supplies. So it's a number of moving targets that we have to kind of balance. So there isn't a set number. It's kind of a range of numbers, and it's really based upon that individual facility's requirements that day.
Well, I mean, statewide, are there any ballpark figures?
I don't have the ballpark. I don't have any numbers in front of me currently for what they can hold.
Okay.
We're way above. I mean, right now our facilities, most of our facilities are if they're not at capacity, they're getting closer to it. So it's we're very high numbers right now.
I'm just trying to get a sense of what percentage are getting rehabilitated and what percentage are estimated to go.
Well, and at this point, it's kind of early to determine that because, you know, without having all of the data in and once we get all the information from the facilities, when we get the disposition forms, which is what they fill out after the animal, you know, goes through the rehabilitation process, we'll have a better idea. But currently, right now, we're basically triaging. The capability for them to sit and to put data in is very challenging, so we won't have all that information until later in the year as far as numbers that are being rehabilitated.
Okay, and then my last question is, if this is a natural occurring phenomenon, are you at all concerned that taking great steps to save a lot of numbers would have other unlooked for consequences for other parts of the biosphere?
I think for us in the stranding network, and that's why I was talking a little bit earlier about the other aspects of our stranding network, is that while we are putting some animals back out there in relative terms of the overall population, it's very low, and the information that we're gathering from the individuals that we get in is very valuable to us. So our take on it at this point is with the numbers that we're dealing with, we don't really have too many concerns about causing other problems in the biosphere.
Wait, how low are the returns?
Can you clarify? What do you mean by that?
It's very low, the number that you guys are releasing. I think that's what you said.
What percentage of animals have released?
I didn't say anything about the percentage of animals that released. I'm missing your question there.
Okay. Sorry, I must have misheard.
Hey, Jed, we can give you a call afterwards, and we can clarify if you need.
Okay, that'd be great.
Sure.
Thank you. Next question is Eric Anderson. Your line is open and state your affiliation.
Eric Anderson with KPBS in San Diego. I'm not sure who this question goes to, but I'm curious as to what you expect is going to happen over the next month or two especially if your facilities, your stranding facilities, reach capacity.
Well, that's, I think, Sharon, if you want to hit the first part, then I'll hit the second part with the stranding facilities.
Oh, sure. I think that based on what we're seeing at the colonies right now, that we should be bracing for a lot more animals to come in along the coast in the next month to 2 months. Normally, we have strandings in April, May, and June simply because pups are weaning and they're trying to figure it out on their own. In this case, we're going to have, I think, a large number of pups coming in the next couple months. And in the 2013 UME, we saw the highest numbers, and Justin can correct me here, I'm pretty sure those were in February and March, and I would expect the same this year. So I think we are going to be looking at increased numbers still coming in.
Yeah, so March and during the UME was the heaviest month, and so what are our facilities going to do? They're basically going to do the best that they can to handle as many animals as possible in those situations. But that's why we're kind of trying to get the word out now, is that the reality is if that many animals come ashore, we can't take them all in, and animals will have to be staying on the beach, or they'll have to be brought in and humanely euthanized depending on the situation. So it's a challenging situation for all of us, but the reality is there are limitations to what our facilities and our network can handle, and with something this large, it's kind of going outside our resource limitations.
Just kind of following up quickly on that point, how close are you to capacity now based on the number of animals you've already taken in?
So it depends upon the facility, and it's day-to-day. So some of these facilities are at capacity one day, then they'll release 10 or 12 animals, and they'll have some space. So it really depends upon each facility, and it's, again, it's evaluated kind of on a daily basis depending upon the resources that are available.
I might just add one more thing, Justin, is that one aspect of this, which we did see in the 2012-2013 event, was that things did start turning around in the environment in April of that year, so it sort of was pretty bad up until then, and then we started seeing sort of a transition where pups were doing a bit better and they were actually starting to gain weight. So one possibility would be that if this warm water event that's going on off the coast were suddenly to dissipate, things could turn around within, I mean, it would take sea lions a while to respond to that change in their environment, but it could be that things could become a little bit better, and Nate might have some idea on whether or not there's any inkling of whether this event is going to continue to persist or whether there's any change.
Yeah, that's a good question. What's going on with the coastal ocean temperatures really respond to the winds. And because the winds have been weak for much of the last year, it's developed a very large volume of warm water that now isn't just near the surface, but it's from the surface down to depths of as much as 100 meters along much of the coast. So there's a really large body of warm water there that now isn't likely to change much very rapidly unless we get a persistent pattern of winds that are strong out of the north that start to initiate those currents from the north to the south, and even sort of more importantly, upwelling intensely to try and tap into the cold water that is below the surface. But what has happened in past periods when you develop this very thick layer of warm water at the surface during the winter is the initial upwelling doesn't effectively pump up a lot of cold water to the surface because it's only really drawing water from about 50 to 100 meters depth. So you can just start upwelling this sort of nutrient-poor, warm, subtropical water and not see a big change in ocean temperatures unless the winds really stay strong for an extended period. And on average, Southern California and sort of Central California start to have lots of wind out of the north and lots of upwelling as we get into the spring, especially starting in, say, March. So we're nearing the season where we expect to see a lot of wind out of the north. I think there will likely be a delay in the cooling of the coastal waters relative to a normal year, even if the winds are normal. And that means you know, at least we'll have another month or two of especially warm water along the coast, unless there's a real dramatic change in the weather, which I don't think there's any indication that that's going to happen.
Thank you. Next question, Sanjana Chand. Your line is open and state your affiliation.
ABC 7 News, San Francisco Bay Area. My question, I'm not sure who this would go to, but I've read previously that 300,000 sea lions usually are on the coastline. Is that correct? And how much of that percentage is usually rescued?
Sharon, you want to talk about the total population? I can try to talk about the rescue.
Sure. So the total population estimate is in 2011 was 300,000 roughly for the United States.
Okay.
That stretches all the way from Southern California or Mexican border all the way up to Washington State. And the animals move around. They're not necessarily all concentrated on the coast. Their breeding colonies are located in the Southern California Bight on the Channel Islands, which is where a large number of the animals will aggregate during the summer months from June through August. And then during this time of year and during the winter, the males and a lot of the juveniles and females that aren't reproductive will sort of move northward, and there's a larger shift of animals coming north into Monterey Bay and San Francisco and then all the way up into Oregon and Washington for better access to foraging resources that are in those areas. And then the females that have dependent pups, they stay in the Central California, Southern California area because they have to return back to the rookeries for most of the year to take care of their pups. So they're really not, it's not as if you have 300 animals sort of sitting on the coastline. They're sort of traveling through the waters along the offshore coast there, and then when they're needing to rest or haul out, they have certain areas that they like to congregate in, which usually are associated with aggregations of prey.
Thank you.
And so what was the second part of that question then?
How much the 300,000 percentage is rescued?
That I don't have that number right here in front of me, but I mean if you're talking about rescued, you know, in the UME year we had 1,300 animals come in, and 1,300 is like a half a percentage of 300,000. So, you know, if you use that as an example, it's a very small percentage.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Next question, Erica Ritchie. Your line is open and state your affiliation.
Yes, Erica Ritchie with the Orange County Register. My first question is to Justin. How long are the sea lions generally at the facilities for rehab?
It depends upon the facility and how often they're able to feed the animal, the resources. So again, it's not a real easy, clear-cut answer of a specific time. It's also based on the individual animal, how well they feed, how well they take to feeding off of live fish versus tube feeding. So there's a number of factors that play into that. And one of the things that we did from the 2013 UME was actually develop some guidelines that we basically provided the facilities to give them some information to help basically pick the animals that we feel have the best chances of survival based upon some of the intake weights and sizes and some of that stuff. So it's another thing that we've learned through some of these animals coming in is, you know, how we can get better and what we're doing. But there really isn't a set amount of time per each animal.
And when you say not a set amount of time, I mean, could we guess that the average animal, and I totally understand what you're saying about all the different factors, but could we say on average an animal would stay 3 to 5 weeks?
I think that that's, again, depending upon those animals, and I don't have the averages in front of me, but it is a number of weeks that the animals are staying there. So it's not like they're in and out in a day or two. It's weeks, if not maybe a month or more. And, again, depending on the weight that they come in, the health status that they're in, how well they take to food, you know, all of these different factors. So it really varies on an individual basis for each animal.
Okay, great. Thank you. My other question is for Sharon. when you went out to the rookeries now at the end of January, what did you find as compared to what you had seen in September and then again in November in 2014?
So when we went back out in February, we went to both San Nicolas Island and San Miguel Island to sort of just check on the condition of pups and to assess mortality on the rookeries. Pups were in very poor condition at both islands, a little bit worse at San Nicolas and San Miguel, but at both islands, pups had lost a tremendous amount of weight. The pups that that we had weighed in September and then recaptured in February to weigh again, majority of them had lost weight. And on average, we were looking at something like, a 10-kilogram underweight for what they should be at this age at both islands. So very poor condition, very, very low growth rates. That was a trend we saw. We did sample a small sample of animals in December of 2014, which isn't part of our normal long-term monitoring program, but we were out there to satellite tag the females. And those pups that we weighed in December were also showing this very slow growth and poor condition, and so that basically just continued to deteriorate from September all the way to February. Pups just continued to get in poorer condition over that four-month period.
So from September to February, you said, was their condition worse than what it would have been in 2012 leading up to the UME?
It's very similar. The growth rate is lower, though, so it would be, using that as our metric, we would say it's slightly worse than it was in the 2013 UME, just for this period between September and February. Mm-hmm. So it does look like they are on track to do at least as badly as they did in 2013, possibly worse. Particularly if the oceanographic conditions don't turn around. We would be looking at poor survival, lots of strandings from now until their normal weaning period in April, and those that make it to April were probably going to be very small when they are weaned, and they probably are going to have very poor survival in their first couple of months on their own.
So overall, if we looked at a mortality rate for the pups this year compared to the UME, what percentage worse could it be for them now?
Well, we don't actually have that number yet, and we actually don't have it for the 2013 UME either, because the survival rates lag behind the actual years just because of the way we do the analysis. But I would, we estimated that in the 2013 event, we may have lost as much as 70% of the 2012 cohort in that before they weaned, and then we probably lost another percentage once they weaned and couldn't make it on their own, although conditions had improved a little bit, so they might have done a little bit better, or had better chances anyway. In this particular event, we just don't know what that number will look like. We're still not seeing much mortality on the islands themselves between September and now, which was also what we saw in the 2013 event. And we think that's just because the pups that are there are being provisioned by their mothers. Their mothers are returning back and taking care of them. But those that finally decide that they are so hungry that they need to go out and find something on their own, those are the pups that are then washing ashore on the beaches here. And so the mortality is occurring on the coastal beaches instead of at the rookeries.
Thank you. Next question, Mary Poppenfuss. Your line is open and state your affiliation.
Hi, I'm with Reuters. Sharon, this question is for you. So you just said 70% in 2013 compared to 2012 died before weaning, you think, and 20% after. So it was a 90% loss of pups that year?
No, I think what I said was that in the 2012 cohort, which was part of the 2013 UME, we
right.
estimated that as many as 70% of those pups may have died before weaning. We don't
right.
have the estimates of post-weaning for that cohort yet because we're still we have to have a couple years post that cohort in order to do the survival analysis. This year, we look like we're on par for probably a similar mortality rate. We just don't have those data yet. We won't really know. Our assessments on the islands are indicating a pretty similar situation, so we would guess that it's probably going to be something like 70% of them dying before weaning, and then some proportion, if this oceanographic condition does not turn around in the springtime, as Nate was suggesting, it means that it will be poor conditions for pups when they do wean.
After weaning.
And that's likely to increase mortality.
And you said it was the lowest weight gain ever observed since, and you've been doing this how many years, did you say?
The weight gain part of it, the growth part of it, we've been
right.
doing since the early 1990s. We've been doing the weight measurements in September for over 40 years, so since 1975, actually. But the growth part of it started a little bit later, and that's been going since the early 1990s. And that's just at San Miguel Island. Our program at San Nicolas started in 2005, so we don't have nearly the kind of data train there as we do at San Miguel. But the most of the data I'm talking about is based on our long-term trend data from San Miguel Island.
And you say the females seem to be foraging in the same areas, but you don't know what the prey fish, I mean, so you're speculating maybe that the fish they're hunting, it takes them longer to get the fish, but they're not actually traveling longer distances to follow these fish possibly.
Yeah, so far from the satellite tracking data we have, it suggests that they are using their traditional foraging areas, and females are restricted in where they can go because they have to return back to the island in order to nurse their pup, and they do have some kind of restriction on where they go. That generally, for San Miguel females, that means between the islands and Monterey Bay is sort of their general foraging area. In severe years, like in the 98 El Nino, for example, they'll go all the way to the Farallones. But those are extreme distances for them to travel. And when they travel farther, they will stay out longer. But sometimes they stay out longer even though they're in their same foraging area, which is sort of what's happening this year. They're not really increasing that foraging distance. But they, if they're having trouble finding food, they'll stay out longer. And that's, in El Niño's what we see is that the prey becomes much more dispersed, and it makes it much more difficult for them to get prey quickly. And so they have to do a lot more sort of moving around to try to find enough prey, and that can sometimes mean that they're out longer, and that means the pup is fasting longer on the beach.
Right. Thanks. Nate, and I have a question for you. You say this is, there's no obvious El Nino event, but the warming is due to a small number of persistent patterns. Is that a euphemism for global warming?
Oh, no, it's not. It is. It's more regional than global. It is just the fact that we've had these kind of persistent weather patterns, like the one that has caused this extended drought in California. It is related to what's going on in the ocean as well, that these patterns that are keeping storms from coming to California that started in 2013.
Right, and it's a mystery why this is occurring.
They seem to be of natural origin, just part of the kind of natural variability of the climate system that wanders around.
Right.
Sometimes these kind of events happen for no apparent reason. There's some suggestion that patterns of ocean temperature change in the western tropical Pacific might have contributed to our drought and at the same time these wind patterns over the ocean, but that connection is not so strong that people predicted this, whereas a lot of thinking was that the El Nino in the tropics was going to get very strong based on many predictions and just our observations from the spring of 2014, things were lined up to warm up rapidly, and then that never happened. It just kind of faded away throughout the summer to the point now where the area where people in the climate world look for this globally significant El Nino change in ocean temperatures, it's a little bit colder than average in much of that kind of eastern half of the tropical Pacific. Yet when we get into our latitudes off the west coast of the U.S. and off of Baja, the ocean is very warm. And it's because of the just this regional wind pattern that has sort of changed a couple of times. You know, we had a very wet spell in November and December in California, but that particular sequence of storms also helped boost the warming along the coast by bringing very strong winds out of the south. And those winds out of the south are great at suppressing upwelling, moving warm water from the south to the north, and moving warm water from offshore to onshore. So all those things together
It's a puzzling, quirky weather pattern that happens from time to time, regionally, right? Is that what you're saying?
That's right. And usually it just doesn't last 4 months at a time. It just doesn't stick around for a whole year. It's more episodic, you know, a week like this and then a week in a different kind of pattern back and forth. That would be a more normal winter. And this has been an unusual year in that the things have gotten stuck for months at a time.
Okay, my last question is for all of you. If someone could give me some sort of reading on this, like, how do you feel about this? Is this unprecedented? Is this something we should be keeping our eye on? Somewhat concerning? Is it alarming? You know, in your history of working on the West Coast, what does this look like to you?
You know, for me, it's really interesting because we have invested a lot of effort. You know, the science community has invested a lot of effort trying to understand how El Nino works and how it influences things like the coastal ocean off of California, Oregon and Washington, all the way up to Alaska. And we get surprised by these kind of events. And this one, to me, is going to have scientists busy trying to sort out what happened on the climate end, and then in working with ecologists to try and understand how did this play out to impact the zooplankton communities, small forage fish like anchovies and sardines, larger predators like seabirds, marine mammals, salmon, all the way up to whales. You know, there's a lot of puzzles here that we're trying to put together, and I'm not really alarmed by it because I think kind of thing that has happened in different ways in the past. It's likely to continue happening in the future. But scientifically, it's really interesting, and I don't see it as something that we should be really alarmed about.
That's thanks. And Sharon, how do you feel?
Oh, I think that's true, that alarm is probably not really the word, but it's sea lions, this is the third event we've had. We had in 2009, we had an unprecedented mortality of pups again in 2013, and now this year, and it seems as if everything's just trying to adjust to changes that are happening, you know, regionally and locally in their environment, and that things are just trying to come back into balance. And so I think that's really what's going on here. I don't think there's any reason to be concerned at a population level at all for California sea lions, but it certainly is a trend that's occurring in the population that we haven't seen since it was protected in 1972. And so it definitely is, as Nate says, it's a very interesting scientific experiment, sort of watching how these populations are going to adjust to this increased kind of variability in their environment and some of these events that are very localized and very unpredictable, and the animals are sometimes responding, their lag, they sort of have a lag in how the environment changes and then their ability to respond to it. So I think that we will see these events coming and going, and as Nate pointed out, we have seen them in the past, although they usually had a much more direct answer to why they were occurring. But it is largely just the system sort of coming back into balance.
So this is a record number of strandings as far, I mean, if you talk about the 2009, an unprecedented number, this is a much higher number already, right?
Well, in 2009, that wasn't strandings. It was a different type of event in that it was about a two-month period where we saw just massive mortality on the rookeries. So it was a different type of event, and I was just, my main point was just that we've lost large numbers from three cohorts in the last few years due to environmental events. So that event was also due to just a very regional, very localized, very short-term event that happened off Central California, and its timing was just really perfect to really have a dramatic impact on newborn pups. These events that we've seen in 2013 and now in 2015 are impacting sort of a different stage of the life cycle of the pups, but still it's going to dramatically impact survival of those cohorts.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you. Next question, Katie Steinmetz. Your line is open and state your affiliation.
Hi, Katie Steinmetz with Time Magazine. A couple questions. One, am I understanding correctly that one way or the other, the abnormally warm water is definitely a culprit in what's going on?
I would say, and Nate can follow up with this too, I think that our sense is yes, that it's causing some sort of redistribution and availability of prey to sea lion females, and that they're having difficulty finding enough prey in order to have their normal support for their pups.
Okay, but it's just unclear exactly, you know, what is going on in that interaction between the warm water and what's happening with the prey that's leading the moms to be out longer, the pups to be smaller, and then forage out incapable of hunting on their own and washing up on the shore and starving there. Is that sort of the correct chain of events?
Yes, I guess, yes. Females are traveling out. They're having trouble finding food. As Nate said, that this warm pool is not only, it's not just a surface condition, it's going down as deep as 100 meters. And for sea lion females, they can dive down to 500 or 600 meters. It's just that most of the time their foraging takes place in that upper 75 meters of the water column. And so if they're having to dive deeper to find prey or having to, or if the prey is less dispersed, and the fishery surveys have been conducted by Southwest Fisheries Science Center, and those data just aren't available yet. They're collating those, and probably within, you know, a month or two, there'll be some more information on the actual prey dynamic that's going on. But based on what we know from other warm water events, usually what it is that the prey assemblage is sort of either moving deeper in the water column, moving farther offshore, farther inshore, farther north, and it's just less available to females. And so then that sets in motion sort of an inability of them to support their pup, and then that ends up slowing the growth and slowing survival.
Okay. Another question. Oh,
go ahead.
Oh, no. I was just going to go on to the next question if you have something else.
I was just going to add that this West Coast region, along California's coast especially, is one that is very dynamic from winter to summer and then sort of between years because of the way that the winds are so powerful and influential and causing the variability here. And, you know, now we have enough kind of historical occurrences of these warm periods to see some common things happen when the upwelling essentially fails or is weak and ocean temperatures get really warm. The marine food web responds in pretty dramatic ways, such that a lot of southern or offshore species end up moving inshore, and then the things that are kind of more normally found in the nearshore areas of California tend to move north.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what, you know, we see again this year. Even though there's no tropical El Nino at work, a lot of the same kind of things are happening. I mean, it's never kind of exactly the same thing that happens from one year to the next in these warm events. But some of the common things are pretty big changes in the community of creatures that you find along the coast.
And sorry if I missed this before, but I know we've sort of traced the root cause of that warm water to these weak winds from the north. Is there also a root cause to that? Is there another domino behind it that is affecting why these winds are the way they are? Or is that, you know, as the previous reporter was saying, just something quirky that we don't understand?
for me, I don't understand it. I think that the take on it right now is it's a mystery. Not clear where it's coming from.
Okay. And another question, just to get some perspective. In a year when things are normal condition, manageable populations at the straining network, what is the mortality rate like among a cohort of pups, you know, to sort of give us a comparison to what's happened in 2009, 2013, and now?
In a good year, we would be looking at maybe up until, you know, the weaning stage, so from birth to weaning, we'd be looking at maybe like a 30% mortality rate. So we're talking about significantly larger mortality, and that can spread sometimes to as much as, you know, 40%. It's variable, quite variable. Cohort, it sort of has cohort strengths like fish species and other things do, but on average, mortality in that period from birth to weaning is something like 30%. So it's a much, this is much, much higher than what would be normal.
All right, thank you. Next question, Mary Callahan. Your line is open and state your affiliation.
Yes, this is Mary Callahan with the Press Democrat newspaper. I have quite a few questions. The reference that you made earlier, Nate, I believe it was, to some other kinds of creatures that were expressing variable behavior this year, can you identify any of those? And absent the specific survey data on fish, are there anecdotal observations of change in distribution of some of the normal prey?
Sure. Among the things that have been noted, you know, especially Southern California, starting early in 2014, the kind of subtropical species that people usually go to Baja to fish for, like Dorado or yellowfin tuna, yellowtail, were being caught consistently near the ports of Southern California, indicating that the habitat that these subtropical animals like had expanded into the Southern California bite area. And more recently, they had some wash up of pelagic red crabs that, again, are sort of a Baja creature that ended up on the beaches of Southern California. There were sort of widespread strandings of Valella, the little sort of by-the-wind sailors on the beaches of Northern California and Southern Oregon.
What were those?
This summer. Valella?
Valella?
Yeah. You Google it, you'll see what they are. Okay. You've probably seen it if you've gone to the beach before, but they are just a small animal that are found in really big colonies that get washed up onto the beaches when the winds are from the south and onshore for enough time to move kind of offshore waters. Something that was encountered in a survey that our lab did in July was kind of a northward and inshore distribution of ocean sunfish, or the Mola Mola, that once our survey reached about Point Arena, and they were within 20 miles of the coast all the time, they sort of intercepted this warm water that had surged to the north and inshore, and they started catching lots of Mola Mola. And in most years, they don't catch any. And they're targeting juvenile salmon. And when they started catching Mola Mola, they stopped catching salmon, which is just another indication that the habitat, you know, this really dynamic pools of water that are being moved around by the winds and the currents had really changed its spatial distribution. And we had kind of the offshore southern water now moved right up close to the beaches of Central California. And there were other observations of loggerhead sea turtles near the Farallones, which were unusual. I think green sea turtles as well. Number of different marine mammals that have been documented in some of the marine mammal surveys that our lab does out of the La Jolla office. And I won't give you all the details of that because I'll probably get them wrong, but there are some reports that we have on the internet that detail some of these observations down to the different species and where they were seen. But they're just a whole suite of different animals. Some are really good swimmers and some are really weak swimmers. that have changed their distribution. And maybe you've read about these nudibranchs that are typically found in Mexico and Southern California, now being found in the intertidal zones of Central and Northern California, another indication that we've got currents that are moving, weak swimming creatures far to the north of where they're typically found.
Okay. And one of the news accounts of this issue with the sea lions I read identified sea lions as a sentinel species, and I'm not sure how you define that exactly, but are there sort of broader concerns here for the implications of what's happening with the sea lions, for the larger environment?
Well, we do, we view California sea lions as an indicator species for the health of the system for lots of reasons, because they're at the top of the food chain. They sort of integrate everything, productivity all the way from, you know, condition of phytoplankton to zooplankton all the way up the chain. And so in that sense, when they start doing poorly, usually it's an indication of things that are amiss lower in the trophic levels. And they integrate a lot of other aspects of health of the system, like contaminants and other things that influence their reproductive rates and their survival. So they are viewed as an important indicator. They also, for a marine mammal, they respond actually quite quickly to a change in their environment. So, for example, in the 2009, when I was talking about that 2009 event where we had a huge mortality occur during June and July, and there was this kind of warming event that started in May and sort of turned around by August of that year, we had this within a number of weeks. We had regular production in that year. Females came, give birth just like they normally should. But within 2 weeks after a lot of them giving their birth, or the mean pupping period, we had massive mortality. And it was simply that females within that two-week period, they could not find enough support for lactation. And so it was a very quick response. You tend to think of them having blubber and having this ability to buffer a little bit, but they really don't have that much buffer. And so when something goes amiss in the environment, they're pretty quick to pick it up. And so that's why they're kind of considered a sentinel or an indicator species of general health. They're also very visible, unlike cetaceans or a lot of the fish species that have a lot going on underneath the water, but you don't get access to them the way we do sea lions. We can see sea lions throughout the year. The public can even witness, you know, changes in their distribution as environmental conditions change. So that's what also makes them a really great indicator of things that might be going on in the system. And I think, as you know, they've been showing kind of a long-term trend in their condition, a sort of a downward trend since 2009. We know that some of the prey species that they rely on have also been sort of in this downward sort of trend in terms of their availability in the system. And so they are, it's just kind of showing that link is pretty strong, in that if we watch them, we can actually get some cues onto what else is going on in the environment.
Thank you. Next question is Deborah Brennan. Your line is open and state your affiliation.
Deborah Brennan, UT San Diego. I just wanted to clarify a couple of the numbers. Could you give us a clear idea? You said that so far there have been over 900 strandings this year. What would be the number you would normally expect by this time? That's my first question.
Hold on a second. You kind of cut out in the first part. Can you say that one more time?
Sure. There were various numbers thrown around as far as how the number of strandings this year compares to normal. Can you give me an estimate of how an actual number of strandings you would normally expect by this time of year compared to the 900-plus you've seen already?
Yeah, so our average, you know, we're looking at, again, mostly in the months of January, February, March, and April for what the numbers I have here. The average strandings for California sea lions during those years is around 225 or something like that for those 4 months. So that's an average total, again, and that's over only from 2004 to 2015. So there's just that 10-year period that I have those numbers for right here.
Okay, so we're already almost four times at that level just in the first month and a half of the year.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And Sharon, do you have any idea what this will mean for their population? You said the last survey in 2011 showed their population at 300,000. Are there any estimates of how these multiple years of low survival will affect that?
No, not yet. They are working on getting new estimates. They did surveys in 2013, and they're going to be sort of putting those. Takes them quite a while to get through those surveys to get total population estimates. So that'll be coming. I think that the generation time for sea lions is between 5 and 7 years. So if you have five or three, we've had three cohorts in the last 6 years that have had very poor survival. The cohort, the pup cohort itself, and then in addition to that, we've also had poor yearling survival. So they've sort of had a double whammy there. And so, sure, that's eventually going to work its way into the number of animals that are alive and in the population and reproducing. It's unlikely, I think, at this stage for it to cause any kind of really significant really critical sort of drop in the total population. But we expect that we will see some sort of downward sort of population numbers in the coming years just because of these back-to-back sort of events occurring that are reducing survival. And eventually, as those small cohorts sort of all become the core population that's reproducing in, 5 to 7 years from now, the population will show a bit of a dip. But you could also have some really strong years mixed in there that could sort of buffer that. So it's really hard to estimate what that might look like.
And can you just repeat one more time what some of their prey is and how far the moms are having to go to get it?
Yeah, what we consider their core diet is usually Pacific sardine, northern anchovy, rockfish, Pacific hake. Those are the primary fish species. And then market squid is a very, very important cephalopod for California sea lions, for a lot of marine mammals. And that core diet is kind of, those species are almost always occurring in the diet. It's just that the frequency of them can be quite variable depending on the abundance of those prey in the environment. And then on top of that, they feed on, besides that core diet, then we consider them opportunistic in the sense that they will feed on up to over 100 different prey species that have been identified. So they'll feed on things like myctophids and octopus and red pelagic crabs when they're available to them. They'll eat on a whole host of things that are available to them. But that core diet is really important, and they need some component of those species to sort of thrive and do really well. And in terms of, go ahead.
Oh, no, that's nice. Go ahead.
And then the second part of your question, which is, I'm sorry. What was the second part of your question? It was prey species?
Yeah, you said that sometimes the mothers will have to travel farther, but you're not sure if that's happening now. So if you could clarify.
We'll know more on that, on their actual attendant, what we call attendance, the length of time they're away, once we get to sort of analyzing all the satellite data. But the satellite tracking data that we have so far, which isn't very much, it's just been since December, so we only have about 6 weeks or so, is suggesting that they're really not foraging in areas that they don't normally use. But their normal winter pattern, their summer pattern is very condensed, and it's because the pups are very small and they can't be out long. They have to return back. The pups don't have any blubber layer. Females can't stay out very long. So their trips during the summertime when the pups are newborn are very short. They're usually like 2 days maybe. And then as the pups get bigger, like towards September and October, those foraging trip lengths gradually increase, probably in relation to dispersion of their prey and migration of their prey moving in and out and new things becoming available. And so they sort of expand their foraging range, and it can go all the way up to Monterey Bay, and it can go anywhere from the coast to quite a ways offshore, actually. And so that's kind of what we consider their winter foraging range. And right now, that's where most of the females are staying. They're not really going much beyond Monterey Bay. We have two females that have been wandering up to the Farallones, but then coming back down. And so that they're kind of staying in that core area. And so it suggests to us what we're seeing in terms of the pup growth is that in their core foraging area, the prey just isn't as available to them, and so they're just not able to bring back or bring it back fast enough that they can actually get their pup to grow at a normal rate.
And are they staying out for longer periods?
We just don't really know that yet. We haven't analyzed those data enough that we feel comfortable saying whether they are or aren't. I think we'll know more of that in probably the next month or two. It just takes a while to analyze those data and sort of sort them out from all of the information that's there. So we should know more about that in the coming months. And right now, we don't know. But we do know that they're not really traveling farther. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're not spending a longer period of time away. It just means that they're not traveling outside of their normal range.
Thank you. Our last question comes from Joe Cerna. Your line is open and state your affiliation.
Hi, Joe Cerna, LA Times. My only question is on this UME we're talking about from 2009 and 2013. If and when would 2015 be declared a UME? And is there anything that happens with that? Is there any additional funding or anything that comes with that declaration?
So this is Justin. We're currently going through the process of looking at, if this is going to be a UME or not. So at this point, we can't say whether it is or it isn't. But we are, talking with the working group and looking at, getting clarification on what's happening with it. If it is declared a UME, there are opportunities for more resources for some of the facilities and things like that. So that's one of the things that we would look at. There's also opportunities through Emergency Prescott, so those are some of the other things that we're exploring with our facilities to try to help assist them in these challenging times.
What do you take to declare a UME? Is there a threshold on the mortality rate? When would that come? Would that come at the end of this year, or would that be something that you guys could find in the next few months?
That's something we're going to have to get back to you on, because I don't know the answer to that, and that's something that I'm going to have to talk with headquarters about, so we'll have to get back to you. Maybe you could work with Jim to contact us, and we can work on that.
Okay, and then just the other question on that. When you said additional resources could become available, are we talking resources for research and finding the cause of it, or would it be more on the other end of treatment, rehabilitation, and actually treating the pups that are found?
It's kind of a combination of both, because okay. It's in order for us to be able to get the samples and the things that we want, we need to be able to bring those animals in and apply the supplies, the resources, the staffing to get those. So it's a combination of both of those, because the rehab provides us with those samples to be able to look at that information.
Okay. At this point, the necropsies that you've done on the pups that haven't survived hasn't turned up anything unusual in terms of what they found in their stomachs, the prey, the things that they're eating? It's just been mostly the weight?
Yeah, there's nothing outstanding on our gross exams at this point that's been brought to my attention.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thanks, John. So I think that's it. Candy, is that correct?
Yes, we're showing no further questions.
Okay. Thanks, everybody, for hanging in there. I know this is it's a long but very interesting subject. So I do want to remind you my phone number is 562-980-4006. If you have any follow-up questions you want to have answered. So, and again, I will make the recording available online as well. So thank you very much, and thanks to the guests here too, the presenters. And thank you very much, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for your participation. That does conclude today's conference. You may disconnect at this time.